There's a whole a gap of over 100 till we get to Russia with 629, and then Rwanda with 604. The lowest, apart from some small islands, is Burkina Faso with 23. And you might wonder where this information comes from. It's all available on a website called www.prisonstudies.org, where you will find information on all the prison systems of the world. There are big differences between seemingly similar countries. The US, 756. Next door, Canada, 116. That's a big difference. The US is more than six times Canada. Spain, 160. Portugal, a little bit down there, 103. England and Wales, 152. Germany, 89. What explains these differences? Well, you might think the answers are obvious. There's more crime in some countries than others, and the ones with more crime have more people in prison. I'm sorry, but there's not much evidence to support that hypothesis. We'll try this one. There's less crime in some countries than in others because more of the criminals are in prison. There isn't much evidence for that hypothesis either. In fact, it's not possible to link crime rates to imprisonment rates in any way that will explain the differences I've just given you. There's a man called Tapio Lapiseppala at the National Research Institute of Legal Policy in Finland. He's the man who studied prison population levels over many years, and his view is quite helpful in giving us an answer to the question we started with, what is prison for? He says, and he has many, many charts to prove it, countries with high income inequality have higher prison populations than more equal countries. Countries with low trust in their legal system and criminal justice arrangements have higher prison populations than countries where the system has credibility. The more social trust there is in a country, then the lower the use of prison. And finally, countries that spend more money on welfare spend less money locking their people up. So we know four things about having a lower prison population. It goes with low income inequality, trust in the legal system, trust in each other, and using public money more for welfare than for punishment. And I'll add another. Countries with high prison populations have a tendency to create criminals. What can that mean? Well, to understand that, we have to understand something about crime. There's a very distinguished Norwegian criminologist called Niels Christie. He said once, since crime does not exist as a stable entity, the crime concept is well suited to all sorts of control purposes. It's like a sponge. The term can absorb a lot of acts and people when external circumstances make that useful. This understanding opens up for new questions. It paves the way for a discussion of what is a suitable amount of crime. So what is a suitable amount of crime? Every hour of every day, every minute of every day, events occur that could be described as crimes. People hit each other. People threaten violence to each other. Men lean out of their car windows and threaten to kill or maim other drivers. Not women, men. Property is taken unlawfully. Workers defraud their bosses. Citizens defraud the government. Taxpayers cheat the tax system. Sexual activity takes place involving those below the legal age for such activity. Many human interactions can be defined as criminal acts if someone wants to do so. All day, such actions take place. All of them could be classified somewhere as a crime. And in this country, we have become world leaders at looking at everyday human behavior and searching out aspects of it that can be turned into crimes. Jonathan Simon, who is professor of law at Berkeley, California, calls it governing through crime. He's written extensively about this process in the United States. I'll tell you another story about another human being. Patricia Amos. I don't know her, but I've read a lot about her. She's a mother with three daughters. She's a lady who's had a lot of problems. She had a kidney removed. She became addicted to painkillers. She started taking heroin. But after a while, she managed to get off heroin by undertaking treatment. Her drug problem was over. But her situation got worse and her family life fell apart. Her mother had been looking after them all. One day, the girls came home from school and found the grandmother lying on the floor. She died 24 hours later. After that, Jackie, one of the three girls, became very unhappy and wouldn't go to school. In 2001, not sending your children to school became a crime that carried the punishment of prison. So in 2002, Patricia Amos got 60 days in prison for failing to send her daughter to school. Figures were published late last year which show that between 2003 and 2006, 71 parents, mostly mothers, were imprisoned. Yet last year, in spite of all this, truancy figures were at their highest since 1997. So how do we go about this process of creating criminals? We do it by putting on crime spectacles when looking at certain people. There's a very disturbed child. Adam Rickwood was a disturbed child. But the authorities put on the crime spectacles and they saw a dangerous teenager who is alleged to have attacked another boy. So they saw crime. And they didn't see adolescent mental health unit as the answer, they saw prison. The system chose that set of definitions and we got a tragic outcome. With Patricia Amos, the authorities saw an act that did not fit with the way they wanted to make the world. They saw it as an attack by her on their social policies. School is good, children must go there. How do we get people to make sure their children go there? All of us could have thought of some ways of dealing with Mrs. Amos's problem. Why did Jackie not go to school? Do you think she was frightened that if she left her mother, she'd go back on the heroin? Do you think when she got there, she found it a hostile and frightening place? We don't know, but nobody found out. It became a crime for Jackie not to go to school. Like having a firework in a public place if you're under 18, that's a crime for which you can go to prison. Or breaking the requirements of an antisocial behaviour order. This is something I read last month. Jonathan Holmes was yesterday jailed for 8.5 months by a district judge sitting at Wisbeach Courthouse. The judge activated an 8-month suspended sentence and added another 2 weeks for the antisocial behaviour order breaches. Holmes, a persistent shoplifter, was banned from several areas of the town under the order and was spotted back in town by members of the public. The police inspector in Wisbeach said, "This is a very strong message to people who are subject to an ASBO." Holmes had not committed any other offence apart from breaching his ASBO. He was seen twice in an area that he's not allowed to be in. On one occasion, he was seen in the horse fair, and on another, he was seen looking through the window of Boots. On both occasions, it was the community that informed us of the breach. Whereas before, we would have had to wait for a theft offence or something similar to have occurred, now the community can act before a crime occurs. I would have thought that that view of the law might make the lawyers in this room just a little nervous. Jonathan Simon from California sums it up. Social problems ranging from welfare dependency to educational inequality have been reconceptualized as crimes, with an attendant focus on assigning fault and imposing consequences. The result of this process is not to make communities safer, but the opposite. And Jonathan Simon says the outcome is to erode social trust, and with it, the very scaffolding of a free society. So what is prison for? Last week, a man standing at a bus stop with his 3-year-old daughter on the way to visit his wife and newborn baby in hospital was stabbed. Prison is for the person that stabbed him. We can, I think, all agree on that. Prison is for people who traffic women and children. Prison is for organized crime syndicates that terrorize and intimidate. We can agree on that. But if prison is for people who commit such appalling acts, can it also be for Adam Rickwood, Patricia Amos, and Jonathan Holmes? If prison is to show that an act is heinous and puts the perpetrator beyond being in society, and prison is to protect society from people who would stab others at bus stops, what's it doing holding the sick mothers, the children with behavioural problems, the persistent shoplifters? What is prison for now in countries like this one, where the number of people in prison has increased by 30% in the last 10 years, and where the government is undertaking a program of building another 20,000 places? Each prison place costs about £100,000 to build. What is prison for? It could be said that prison is for the unwanted of the current economic model. How do we know that they're unwanted? We know because of what we are doing. We know because if we wanted them, we would do something else. We would look at their problems and their situation and we would say, you need a bit of sorting out. You need help to be a functioning member of society. And because you are wanted as a citizen, as a taxpayer, as a contributor, here is help. Here's healthcare, here's drug treatment, here's education, here's social support. And then these unwanted people, once the crimes have been created to catch them, become the raw material of economic development in depressed areas like Yamaguchi in Japan. And if the government has its way, in Warrington, in the north of England, where the local community wants a business park and where the government is trying to persuade them to agree to a plan for a Titan prison, a giant prison holding 2,500 prisoners, trying to persuade them that that's not a bad substitute for a business park. So what is the future, do we think, for this way of dealing with the unwanted people? Well, this event is taking place at an interesting time for the world, as the ideology of unrestrained market forces sinks like a deflated hot air balloon onto the pavements of Wall Street. Maybe this is the time when money is short, when social solidarity will be what keeps us going. This may be the time that putting more and more poor people, more and more black people into prison on the false promise that this will make us safer goes out of fashion. If that's the way it's going to go, then I, for one, shall be celebrating, because I know that as I become more and more, and I'm certainly getting there, more and more of a little old lady, I shall be a lot safer and find myself in a kinder world when we've stopped using punishment as a tool of social policy. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for your patience in listening. I'm happy to lose my voice.
I was thinking throughout a lot of it that one of the mantras of Tony Blair, that Blair was taking his career when I think he was Shadow Home Secretary, tough on crime, tough on the cause of crime. And reflecting sadly how the second half of that mantra has not been addressed by government since, there's now an underclass which is possibly more alienated from society, arguably at any time in our history. How do when government of whatever political hue sees the need for draconian penal policy as a prerequisite for re-election?
Yes. How do we? Well, we try. We try a lot. And I think that it can only be about, as I hinted at the end, and it doesn't sound very serious, but it is going out of fashion. You reach the end of a certain road, and a lot of reasons why you might reach the end of that road, and it may be money is a reason. Because as long as we stay within the European Convention and have to keep prisoners in certain standards and provide health care and provide space and food and so on, it will continue to be expensive. And it's hard to tell. We live in very interesting times. But in times when there's less inequality, when people are more equal, even when people are poorer, support for harsh measures goes down. In the 1960s in the United States, support for the death penalty was under 50%. And in the last few years, it's been around 80 or so, and it's going down again. So it is a very difficult thing to predict. But one has to assume that it reaches a point, and I think this might be happening in the United States, it reaches a point where you can't go on doing it, I hope. And the costs of doing it and the political benefits to be gained by going on doing it don't any longer seem so great. We'll have many other things to worry about, won't we? Unemployment, people losing their homes, there'll be a lot of protests. Crime will no longer be the thing that people can use. Criminals will no longer be the scapegoat that politicians can necessarily put all their efforts into because they've got bankers and they've got all sorts of other enemies. And it's possible that people will feel more tolerant when lots of people can't really manage on the money they've got. How you make politicians do it, I don't know. It's interesting that there's a minority government in Scotland. Not many people know about this. It's not very well publicised. But they have this minority government in Scotland which has an avowed policy to reduce the number of people in prison considerably and to instead tackle the drink, the drugs and the poverty that are underlying it. And this is not a policy that's making them unpopular. In spite of the Labour Party behaving in a most disgraceful fashion in trying to whip up hostility against that policy. So it does seem to me that if you do other things right as a politician, you don't need to use crime, and that once two political parties decide not to do it, it can stop tomorrow. And I'm just hoping that the current problems we face will mean they'll have to do that. But it is very difficult to stop them, and one does try, but it's not easy.
The next question, asked by a gentleman from Pakistan, was off microphone, so sadly inaudible, but the response is illuminating.
Yes, 7,000 prisoners in India, in Pakistan. That's a big prison, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, but my experience of countries like yours, prisons, it's very difficult for prisons to be afforded, actually. The colonial powers came along and said, this is what you do, and this is the sort of building you have, and you have a building, no doubt, that's a bit like Wormwood Scrubs in West London, and this is imprisonment, and you've got the rule book dating from the colonists in 1894, and then they all went home and left many countries with a completely dysfunctional system, because the cost of such a system is not affordable in the economic situation that you're in. And this is not easily solved, because I've seen over the last 20 years projects to try and solve it in Pakistan, in India, in Bangladesh, in Nepal, everywhere. There have been projects. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, the outcome is not great. Prison conditions are not that much better in any of the countries. And it may be that prison should be used in countries that are very poor, very, very sparingly. And then you would be able to have prison staff who were paid a living wage, who didn't have to rely on corruption and payments from prisoners in order to have enough money to feed their families, and they would be on a level with police and get that respect. But it's not been very easy to sell that message in any of the countries that I think we're talking about. But there's no doubt that a prison reform project should start with prison staff. And if you look at the handbook on human rights and prison management from the International Centre for Prison Studies, which is also on our website, you will find that prison staff is the introductory chapter, because at the core of what a prison is like is the relationship between the prisoners and the staff, and the frontline staff, not the big bosses in the back office so much, but what happens on the front line. And therefore, investing in prison staff is the way that you reform prisons, and I entirely agree with that. But I don't know how you would persuade your government, or any other developing country would persuade their government, to put their money into prisons at a time like this. It is extremely difficult. And I have enormous sympathy for anybody who tries to do prison imprisonment properly in a very poor country, because it's a soul-destroying, difficult job.
The next questioner made the point that Vivian Stern talked about reducing prison population, but wouldn't people be outraged if people were not sent to prison for crimes they'd been found to have committed?
Yes. I'm very glad you made that point, because I don't want people to think that I'm advocating impunity, that I'm saying nothing should happen when bad things happen to people. I'm not saying that at all. I think it's deeply important that when bad things happen to people, there should be a response that recognises what's happened to them. So I would personally think that we would do better if our victims' services were better, if there was more, if more resources were put into making sure that those who had suffered were recompensed, if poor people could get insurance so that they didn't lose all their possessions when there was a burglary, if there were insurance schemes for poor people in places where insurance companies won't go, and if there was more support for victims, then that would help people to feel that what had happened to them was recognised. Because at the moment, what do they get? What you are supposed to ask for, if you had a crime done to you, is punishment for the person. That's what's expected. The television camera will come in, and the victim will say, I don't know how 5 years could be seen as enough for what happened. And that person is absolutely right, because you can't measure the suffering of somebody in the years of somebody else's punishment. It's not doable. So we need to try and think of it a different way. We need to be much more upfront in ensuring that people do not suffer so much from crime, don't get left and get nothing back. And then we have to look at those who've done it. And we have to, first of all, move out of it people who are doing these things because they're ill, one. This boy, Adam, was ill. I don't think there's any doubt. He was a really disturbed child. The poor old persistent shoplifter who looked in the window of Boots, I guess he was a homeless alcoholic, wandering about. Quite glad to go back to prison, actually, because there's nothing else for him much. Why we sent Mrs. Amos to prison for not sending her daughter to school is beyond me. I can see no logic in that at all. But for most people, it would be better. Most people at the lower level that I'm talking about, it would be much better if we solved the problem and if the punishments that are alternatives to prison, of which there are many, they can do work for the benefit of the community. It's a very good thing. Make people who've committed crimes start thinking about other people, sympathising with other people, seeing their plight. It's very educational. It's It's a real way of people changing when they stop thinking about themselves all the time and see that there are other people and that they can help other people. Helping other people is very, very rehabilitative. And also dealing with the drink and the drugs. If people are addicted, there's nothing you can do. Punishment doesn't mean a thing because they're only thinking about that. So I agree with you absolutely, but I'm not going on to say that therefore the answer is punishment. I'm saying the answer is to support victims and to deal with the problems. And if you have public opinion surveys, people all say, I would much rather they dealt with the problem so he didn't do it again. Then I would feel that it was worth happening to me because it's not happening to anyone else. So I'm really suggesting that we should adopt a more practical approach. Try and solve the problem so it doesn't happen again. That would be much better for everybody. Is that helpful?
The next questioner said that the government was talking about restorative justice rather than punitive justice. Is this a hopeful sign?
Well, not as long as the government goes on talking, sort of supporting that with one side of its mouth and then talking up crime and toughness with the other. That actually is the strategy that they're trying to follow in Scotland, which is to make the community payback sentences that you're talking about much more visible, and they want them to start the next day. That's a very important decision, that they put the money in so that when somebody comes up in court and it's sort of said, oh, he got community sentence, he's walked free, nothing will happen for months, it starts the next day. So that community ought to be able to see that the week of the trial and the conviction, somebody's out there cutting the grass in the park and making, you know, whatever they're doing. And in that sense, if a government, it's interesting to see what they're doing in Scotland, because you can see what a government tries to do when they seriously want to do it, and when they don't play this political game of talking it up. And what they are trying to do is what you've suggested, which is to make the community sentences more visible, more credible, people are being involved in saying what the work should be, and there's a lot of support for that in communities where people have to live with people. And they know when they come back from prison, what are they like? They're just rushing to get the next load of drugs and to get drunk or whatever. And it's not effective. So I think it's very marketable if politicians have the sense to do that.
The next questioner inquired about provision for young mothers with children in prison. What would Vivian Stern advise in that case?
It's an insoluble dilemma. Either take the baby in prison with you, horrible, bring your baby up in prison, be separated from the baby, horrible, the worst thing you can do, often. So it's not solvable. So maybe you go back a stage and maybe there's another solution. That we don't send mothers with young babies to prison at all. That's a solution. It was always a feature of the law in Russia and countries that followed Russian law that mothers of young children had their sentences suspended until the children got to 14, by which time they normally didn't have to serve them, because it was felt that there was greater value to society in a child being brought up properly by the mother in a normal environment than in inflicting punishment. And this is now being talked about. It's also Scotland, isn't it? The Children's Commissioner in Scotland is trying to get an amendment to the law that the court has to hear a statement about the effect on dependent children of any sentence, and that the Convention on the Rights of the Child would require the court to think of the best interests of the child when confronted with the mother. So I would like to think that with the new equality duty, there'll be more interest in trying to stop the courts. You do see some really absurd cases where women who are 8 months pregnant and have got two at home are sent to prison. And the judge says, I can't take that into account. You've committed this offence. And you think, what could be going on in that stupid person's head? What does that stupid person think is the consequences? And how does that judge weigh up the social benefit of that decision? So I'm hoping that with more awareness of the fact that there has to be a duty of equality, it might help for the courts to be given more of a... would have to be more reflective on the social consequences of a sentencing decision. If mothers do go to prison with their babies, you do see around the world a vast variety of arrangements. And in the former Soviet countries, they all have well-staffed nurseries. Children stay till they're 8 or something. They are in the nursery. They see their mother in the evening. You also see places in Latin America where they all just live in a nice big family atmosphere. And there's a very, very... a sort of model women's prison in Western Australia where they live in houses with the children and they go to the health centre and it all looks very much like a normal village. It's never the best thing for children.
Like, I really didn't see much change in them. Like, most of them, whether they're 10 years or 3 months, all of them said, okay, I will do the same thing again going out. So to what extent do prisons really contribute to rehabilitate prisoners, change their mind, make them better people?
Well, I have to say that there's no evidence from anywhere in the world that prisons make people better people. And the usual effect of prison is to worsen everything about a person and for a person. That is the inexorable logic of an institution in which you put everybody who maybe shares some characteristics from the most deprived parts of society. You deprive them of the opportunity to be responsible, to be kind, to learn, to... achieve anything. You humiliate them with the clothes you put them in, the fact that there's often no lavatories, the fact that they have to take their clothes off all the time in front of other people to be searched in most, sometimes in most disgusting ways. It is a real feat of human imagination to imagine that that could do any good to anyone. However, it's not nice to think, and this gentleman from Pakistan will understand this, if you run a prison or work in a prison, you want to do some good. Otherwise, what sort of a life is it? And so a good person in charge of a prison tries very hard to minimize those aspects which are so likely to make the person worse. Some Scandinavian prison systems are very realistic, and they put on their website, our prisons are this, our aim is to do the least damage. And that is a very realistic aim, because there's an enormous difference between a decent prison and a horrible prison. A prison can be a nightmare, a hellhole, a place where everyone is in fear, where the strong are terrorizing the weak, where people are sharing needles and getting sick, where the food is being taken away by the staff and sold in the market, and where people are dying who shouldn't die. And there's a whole spectrum, and this is not only poor and rich. This can happen in poor and in rich. And you can also have a prison which, in spite of everything that's difficult about a prison, it is they manage to preserve humanity, dignity, and give people some chance to develop their personality. And that's why prison staff, we come back to your question, are so important, because they could do the one or they could do the other. And the prison reform movement in the world tries to get the good prison that I've described. Even then, though, I have to say, even in a prison where people are not beaten and where it's not corrupt and where they don't have to use the toilet in front of everybody else and where they're not strip searched in a horribly offensive way, a prison will not be a good place. A prison will always be a place which has within it the potential for humiliation, inhumanity, and for not allowing human beings to develop their potential. So don't ever think you can do the best good to anyone by sending them to prison. Only send them to prison when they are the sort of people who've stabbed someone at a bus stop or done something terrible, because it's not going to do society a lot of good to have many people in a place like that. Sorry, I know you wanted to believe in rehabilitation, but I can't tell you what's not true.
The next questioner asked whether there were any model prisons which Vivian Stern would recommend as good practice.
Well, people always ask me that, because people want there to be one, right? And I'm sometimes tempted to make something up. But I have to tell you, no. There are prison systems which are not awful. Norway, Finland, Slovenia, Costa Rica. I'm running out of places. But the truth is, I can't give you the name of a country where you can go and see how it ought to be. No. I can tell you in Western Australia there's one very good women's prison. In Costa Rica they have a couple of very good prisons, but then they also have horrible ones. In Argentina there's a good prison, but the rest of the system is murderous. It's interesting that in the former Yugoslavia, before it all fell apart, they had some of the best. They had the best prison system probably in the world. For some reason, they managed to find the best bits of the Soviet system in terms of rehabilitation, getting people reintegrated, looking after each one to get them back into society. There was a time when Nicaragua had a very good prison population, but this never lasts. So I have to say, don't go looking for it, because it isn't there. Prisons are problematic, sad places, and the best thing is to have as few as possible, have small ones, and pay lots of money to the prison staff so that they look after them really well. That would mean that we were all safer, but nobody's going to do that.
Do you foresee trouble on the horizon in the time of economic difficulties that people are undergoing?
This is one scenario we might face, but I'm not convinced that we will. First of all, it's not absolutely clear that crime rises in times of economic trouble. Some crime will rise, but a lot of violent crime is related to the availability of alcohol. If people can't afford to go out drinking and get too drunk for words and then start stabbing each other, then they won't stab each other and the violent crime rate will be reduced. Maybe more violent acts will happen in the home, but we won't necessarily hear about them. So it doesn't follow that economic difficulties leads to a rise in the sort of crime that is very frightening to people. I was going to say the bankers have already stolen so much money it's going to be really hard to commit crime at that scale ever again. But I won't say that. I'm not convinced that it's going to go that way, but I can see that you have a strong argument for saying it might. I'm just not sure that people will have the appetite to spend all that money when they can all feel that we're under economic pressure, and what's the point of sending all these people who are committing economic crimes like stealing to prison? What's the point of it? We're all in the same boat. I hope it will go that way, but you may be right.
Now, roll on the day, everybody feels free to ask themselves, what is the point? Why am I doing this? What are the long-term consequences of what I'm doing? As we've seen before on the show, the hierarchical nature of society means there's typically very few people who are able to ask that question. Often psychopathic or with sociopathic tendencies towards the top of the hierarchy, most people's freedom of choice is just limited to how can I carry out the orders that I've been given. I think the task that we face is to return to an understanding of the world in which people are understood to do what they think is the right thing, in which it's not acceptable to try to seek power over people, whether through legal, economic, or other means. The logic of the money system, as we've seen before, concentrates wealth in fewer and fewer hands, and that same logic, if it says you're only entitled to houses if you have the ability to pay, and payment must be in this currency, which is a private monopoly issued for the gain of those who control the system, that logic says, well, okay, you guys don't deserve a house, we deserve to take all your property. The first step is to see the fundamental injustice of that kind of thinking, tracing its effect on our other ideas, also a complex one. As an example, do you have a moral right to something because you can pay for it? Do you have no moral right to something because you can't pay for it? These are questions which we are not often encouraged to ask, but I would encourage you as a step towards understanding what you believe as right and wrong, and going outside of prescribed hierarchies of what you are told to do, what you are told not to do, is an uncertain thing, but I think not as uncertain as the future which awaits us if we continue blindly to follow orders. We've seen before what perils await unless we as a people can change directions. Now I'm going to leave the closing word to Charles Eisenstein. This is from his Ascent of Humanity, which is available for download from our website as an audiobook. He's elaborating on the larger picture, humans' fear-driven alienation from the world and desire for control, and of course the intimate connection with the money system.
Life under contract. The tyranny of yes and no, the migration of life to a wholly domesticated realm, and the dwindling of the uncertain and undefined in favor of the expressly permitted and explicitly forbidden takes another form in laws, rules, and regulations. Here, the program of control manifests as a spreading legalism that infiltrates all aspects of modern life. In the ecological sphere, the shrinking of the wild is domestication, confinement, and the great indoors. In the personal sphere, it's the conquest of the child's spontaneity and creativity. In the social sphere, it is the codification of previously informal agreements, ethics, and mores. As legal scholar Paul Campos puts it, anyone who compares the legal domains of our society to those of the pre-modern state immediately becomes aware of a tremendous and ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space. Close quote. Our dependence on authority to delimit the realm of the permissible projects onto the collective level as the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play. Thanks to our schooling, we are accustomed to being told what is allowed, accustomed to authority determining right and wrong, and accustomed to coercive enforcement of these distinctions. Implicit in a world under control is that if something goes wrong, it must be someone's fault. Someone must bear legal responsibility. Someone must be punished, and I should be compensated. And so, children in authoritarian institutions such as schools resolve disputes by telling on each other, going to teacher, the source of authority. In religion, the same tendency manifests in the idea of God as a referee who will reward the just, punish the wicked, and make everything fair in the end. In law, this attitude motivates the burgeoning realm of the regulated, the ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space, and our endemic reliance on lawsuits to resolve disputes. The rule of law has become a necessity as other forms of social coordination have broken down with the dissolution of community. In olden times, informal social pressures were far more potent than they are today, because people depended on their neighbors to meet economic and social needs. The goodwill of the community was extremely important, and the consequences of social shunning severe. Today in America, there are few real communities to speak of, only neighborhoods, and the opinion of neighbors matters little. As long as I obey all the laws, who cares what the neighbors think? I'm safe from anything they might do. I don't need to buy things from them. I don't need them to watch out for my children. I don't use the things they make. I don't depend on them for recreation. The conversion of social capital into money means that just as with all the rest of life's necessities, we rely on remote strangers for dispute resolution. The local and personal has been replaced by the formal and remote. Suppose my son breaks my neighbor's window with a baseball. My neighbor asks me to pay for it. In the past, if I refused, the opinion of the whole neighborhood would turn against me. If I consistently behaved like that, I would find myself unable to get credit at the local grocer's, unable to receive emergency services from the local doctor, unable to get babysitting help when something happened. People depended on the favors and non-monetary reciprocation that we call neighborliness. In most places in America today, few of those mechanisms of social pressure still operate, and my neighbor has no choice but to sue me, resorting to the outright coercive force of a distant and impersonal authority. Impersonality is built into the very concept of law, which is supposed to be objective, rational, and impartial. Disputes are to be resolved not according to who knows who, not according to one's reputation in the community, not according to whom the judge likes, not according to emotional judgments of right and wrong, and not according to popular sentiment, but rather by the impartial application of legal reasoning. That disputes in general can and should be resolved according to logic and principle is a fundamental assumption springing from the Newtonian-Cartesian worldview and modeling itself after axiomatic mathematics. In formal mathematics, we start with basic axioms, the equivalent of a constitution, and reason from those, adding new axioms, legislation, as necessary where the old ones fail to prove or disprove a proposition, resolve a new type of dispute. At the zenith of the age of reason in the early 20th century, David Hilbert enunciated the final goal of mathematics, a complete set of axioms from which all mathematical truth could be deduced. Though Hilbert's program crumbled with the work of Gödel and Turing in the 1930s, in the realm of law, we seem to think that any failure to rationally resolve the disputes of our day can and should be addressed with yet more laws. The end result would be a Hilbertian complete set of principles by which the legality of any act could be determined through unassailable logic. Then the ambiguity of human interaction would be gone. We would have in human relationship the same certainty that physicists have sought for centuries in their quest for a complete universal law, a theory of everything, in which everything would be of well-defined legal standing. Every act would be either legal or illegal. Already, we are so thoroughly conditioned to a world under control that I suspect many people would not see this as an alarming statement. It might even be hard to conceive of any other status, just as it is hard to conceive of a piece of land just existing without being owned. Someone has to own it. It can't just be there. We find it easy to understand. Everything is legal unless expressly prohibited, or everything is illegal unless explicitly permitted, but not that some things simply have no legal status. In any realm, the regime of control demands the elimination of uncontrolled variables, the domestication of the wild. In the realm of law, the wild is the unregulated social space, and the variables represent uncertainty. Law represents the social reification of the technological program, whose goal is, as Campos puts it, quote, the final elimination of risk itself. He goes on to interpret the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play as a contemporary byproduct of the need to deal with the loss of any broadly held belief regarding the point of human existence, close quote. Intuitively, Campos has come close to a central theme of this book, which is that the compulsion to control the world arises out of an alienation which has shorn life of any meaning except the maximization of comfort, safety, and pleasure. Except it is more than a need to deal with a loss of belief that generates the urge to control. Control, rather, is the inevitable logical conclusion of our beliefs themselves. Here's an amusing example of the legalistic program to eliminate uncertainty. Some years ago, I read that the student code at a certain college was amended to require that each new step in erotic foreplay be preceded by the explicit consent of both parties, as in, may I kiss you? Yes. May I caress your breast? Yes, and so forth. No doubt this rule was written to clarify certain situations in which sexual consent was ambiguous, as in, just because I kissed him doesn't mean I gave him permission to grope me, close quote. The solution, define consent with even more rules. Forget the absurdity of the whole thing for a moment and consider the fundamental assumption that a sufficiently minute set of rules can resolve all ambiguity. It's the technological program again. One can imagine a case where the meaning of explicit consent comes into question. Is a sigh of passion enough? Does reciprocation of a caress need prior consent? What about uh-huh instead of yes? Where does the sigh end and uh-huh begin? No doubt we could create even finer distinctions to resolve these ambiguities. But there would be still more ambiguities created by the very attempt to define them away. The parallel with mathematics is uncanny. Gödel demolished Hilbert's program by proving that given any consistent axiomatic system of sufficient complexity, there will be true sentences in the formal language of that system that are unprovable from the axioms. The true sentence, or its negation, could be added as a new axiom, but no matter how many are added, there will always be yet other true statements unprovable from the expanded set of axioms. Similarly, no matter how fine the distinctions of law, there will always be situations that are not logically resolvable from the law. We can add new axioms, new laws, finer distinction, but still, there would be logically irresolvable situations. Steeped as we are in the mindset of the technological program, the solution is nonetheless to always add on more laws, more regulations, in hopes of finally encompassing every possible situation within a legal framework, everything either expressly forbidden or explicitly permitted with no gray areas. The result is, as Campos puts it, the 100-page appellate court opinion, the 200-page, 500-footnote law review article, the 1,000-page statute, the 16,000-page set of administrative regulations. And yet, as the letter of the law swells in exactitude and scope, the spirit of the law withers away and its power to control human behavior diminishes. The extension of law into every corner of life is visible in the increasing pervasiveness of the contract. We enter into contracts all the time without even noticing it. Have you ever noticed fine print saying, quote, by purchasing this product, you agree, ... close quote. At Penn State, by enrolling in the university, the student is legally consenting to abide by the regulations of the voluminous student handbook, and by enrolling in my class is agreeing to the syllabus, which is accorded the status of a contract between the student and the university. A contract is a legal agreement, one that is real in the eyes of the law. Here is the culmination of the confusion between label and object that representational language invites. The reality of an agreement depends on being written down, while consent devolves into a signature. What counts in an agreement? Not the unspoken understanding, nor its social context, but only what is in black and white, words on a page. Of course, the seeming objectivity of a law or contract is an illusion, since the words interpretation and enforcement, indeed, still depend on these more human factors. Expanding legalism rises out of the dissolution of community. Equally, it contributes to it. By relying on outside authority to adjudicate and impose a solution, we are relieved of the necessity of working things out among ourselves. You won't hear from me again, you'll hear from my lawyers. These were the last words a friend of mine heard from a business partner of many years. Another variation, tell it to the judge. Another consequence of social governance by lawsuit and threat of lawsuit is the further reduction of life into money that I discussed in Chapter 4. Damages are calculated in dollars, and it is through dollars that we redress the matters of betrayal of trust, negligence, pain and suffering, and all the other subjects of lawsuits. Generally speaking, when people bring a lawsuit, they are seeking money. What else can you sue for? Remorse? Sympathy? Admission of wrongdoing? When someone is financially compensated for a wrongful death or dismemberment, the underlying message is that money is the equal of life or limb.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.